Velkommen til Dagbladet Informations podcast, Det Store Perspektiv.
Tusind tak, fordi I er kommet. I dag skal vi tale om tipping points.
Mit navn er Mathias Sindberg, og jeg er inviteret i efteråret en række af Danmarks og verdens dygtigste forskere herind på Information til en række arrangementer i kantinen om alle verdens grønne problemer. Man kan nemt få det indtryk, at klimakrisen alene handler om at holde styr på den store globale termostat. Stiger temperaturerne med 1,5 grader, er det til at leve med. 2 grader kan vi måske også klare. Ved 3 grader er der alvorlige problemer, og derfra bliver det rigtig slemt.
Man får hurtigt indtryk af, at det bare er en eller anden form for budgetstyring, at jo flere drivhusgasser vi udleder, jo mere stiger temperaturen. Begrænser vi udledningerne, så begrænser vi også problemerne. Og kan vi bare opfinde en eller anden teknologisk mirakelkur, der kan trække CO2 ud af atmosfæren igen, så kan vi også begynde at rulle problemerne tilbage. Sådan er det bare ikke.
Klimaforandringerne er et enormt kompleks af forbundne kriser. Og for vi mennesker først skubbet tilstrækkeligt hårdt til den yderste dominobrik, sætter vi gang i en proces, vi ikke har nogen som helst kontrol over.
Så er spørgsmålet ikke, hvordan planetens livsbetingelser kommer til at forandre sig, men hvor meget, hvor hurtigt og katastrofalt. Og faktisk er det et åbent spørgsmål, om et par af de dominobrikker allerede er væltet.
De dominobrikker kalder vi også tipping points, og det er dem, vi skal tale om i dag.
As always, I'm just here asking the stupid questions. Luckily, today we have the privilege of getting the answers from two of the world's leading experts on the matter. Catherine Richardson.
No, he's the expert. I just you asked me to find the person that I thought was the person to talk to.
I actually googled a bit around Catherine. You're quite highly regarded in this field as well.
Med mig her i kantinen har jeg Catherine Richardson, der udover at være en god ven af avisen, også er medlem af Klimarådet og professor i oceanografi.
And Tim Linton.
Via en Skype-forbindelse har vi den britiske professor Tim Linton, som for snart 25 år siden var den første til at bruge begrebet tipping points.
Thank you very much for joining us tonight. And if you can already get the sense of, I've spoken to Catherine about you these past weeks, and she keeps referring to you as with names such as like Mr. Tipping Points or the father of tipping points.
God fornøjelse.
So maybe you can start out by explaining to us what made you deserve such a questionable title. What has been your role in identifying the threat of tipping points?
Lord, I didn't call you the grandfather.
No, the grandfather is probably a chap called John Schellnhuber, a good friend who was the founding director of an institute in Potsdam in Germany. But in the early 2000s, John and I were both realizing that there were many parts of the climate system that could exhibit a tipping point toward. If you go past it, you get abrupt and or irreversible change. And we were thinking about this at the time. Malcolm Gladwell had written his popular science book on the tipping point and how small things can make a big difference. And we noticed actually some politicians at the time starting to use the language of climate tipping points. And I think we thought it would be good to recolonize the language and explain that it works also as a scientific concept that we'd known about for many decades, really. But yeah, in the 2000s, we were seeing alarming rates of accelerating change in the Arctic sea ice, the Greenland ice sheet, and so on. So that made it apposite even then to try and draw up a list of the possible climate tipping points and put them on a map, if you like. And that was an exercise that was happening through the mid-2000s, where we were able to convene a group of scientists in the British Embassy in Berlin, of all places, and have an initial workshop on this, and also start what's called an elicitation process to draw out kind of expert views. So yeah, it took a few years for me to finish writing up the synthesis of that, which published in 2008. But I think the map that we made then and the diagrams we made and the summary we made of the tipping points struck a chord, and happily it slowly filtered its way into the collective consciousness, amplified since then by the fact that the Earth system and the climate keeps changing in surprising and sometimes abrupt ways. And I'm sure we'll get to discuss that further, but the last decade or so has seen lots more, I'm afraid, compelling evidence that we might be approaching or even past one or two climate tipping points.
And just to start off with the basics, what is a tipping point?
Well, if I could go first, because I'd like Tim to, this is what I usually say, and I'd like to get it properly approved. We know for certain that there are tipping elements in the Earth system. That means to say, we know for certain there are things that either are there or aren't there at different times of the in the Earth's history. And that can be ice on Greenland. It can be the way the North Atlantic Current brings heat from the Gulf Stream to us. It can be the Amazon. So we know for certain that there are things that either are there or aren't there. And we know for certain that temperature plays a role in when they go from one state to another. And when they go from one state to another, we call it a tipping point. So we know for certain that there are tipping elements. So we know for certain there are tipping points. And we know for certain that temperature plays a role in those tipping points. What we don't know for certain is at what temperature do we cross tipping points? And that's the really interesting question. Did I pass, Professor?
Yeah, you did. If I was in the room with you, I would probably stand up from my chair and show you all that the chair has two different stable states upright. And then if we lie it on its back on the floor, that's pretty stable as well, if it doesn't budge easily. And if I encouraged you two to lean back on your chairs, which would probably be dangerous, you'll get to a point where a little bit of a nudge one way or the other is going to determine whether you end up back upright or sprawled on your back on the floor. That's a kind of tipping point where a very, very small change can make a very big difference to the to your fate. And that's kind of the dynamics we're talking about, as Catherine's nicely introduced, in bits of the climate system. It's a little bit more subtle than that. It's a bit like, as we warm the planet, it's a bit like you're slowly melting the legs of the chair, and the upright state, the current state of things like major ice sheets, is losing stability, and at some point they're destined to collapse. And yeah, just recently I've been updating our assessment of where are those temperature thresholds or tipping points. Suffice to say, they're alarmingly close for several of these tipping elements, as I called them.
Tim, would it be fair to say that the legs of the chair are melting at different rates?
Yeah, exactly. So some tipping elements are closer to a tipping point than others, as we might intuit. And then if we just want to add an extra layer of doom onto this, I'm afraid that when you tip one thing, it can interact with another, because we're dealing with a complex, interconnected, almost living system in our climate. So perhaps that should be intuitive to everybody, that we can say quite concretely what the physical couplings are between, say, the accelerated melt of the ice on the sea in the Arctic and the accelerated warming and melting of the Greenland ice sheet, and how the meltwater pouring off Greenland makes the surface waters of the North Atlantic fresher, and how that tends to slow down and potentially tip a collapse of the great overturning circulation of the Atlantic Ocean. And we know a whole lot about how when you break the Atlantic Ocean circulation, you shift the band of rainfall all the way around the tropics of the planet southwards, disrupting monsoons around the planet in India, West Africa, and so on. So yeah, that's the fifth horseman of the apocalypse role that I...
There's this cascading effect, almost like the butterfly effect, where if you change one thing in one place, then it'll have implications other places and other systems of the world.
Precisely.
But we know that from our own body, which is the system that we know best. I mean, if you're straining because you have a bad knee or something, it ends up hurting your back and a headache, and you know, things are all connected. So we understand our body as a system. We just don't usually think of the Earth as a system.
Do you think there's a lack of awareness in that in the climate debate? I noticed that both of you used the phrase Earth system. I think even Tim, your formal title is Professor of Climate Change and Earth System Science. That's not a phrase you hear all that much, yet it does appear to me that it holds some significance to you.
Oh yes, very much so.
Yeah. In simple terms, I think it's about, what is it, 350 odd years since the original sort of scientific revolution that set us on the path of modernism, as people call it in the academia. But I'm afraid somewhere in the 19th century, you know, the name science was coined, and science busily segregated it off into separate disciplines, which was great if you wanted to, you know, make advances in ultimately in particle physics or whatever. But when the world then confronts you with, oh dear, the collective consequence of all of this is that we're completely changing the climate in our life support system, you're faced with having to put all the pieces back together again to try to understand the system that you're disrupting collectively. And that's why it's so important that new disciplines like system science, or youngish disciplines that 50 years old maybe, like system science, have sprung up, because they're the disciplines that we're going to need to get ourselves out of trouble or navigate the worst.
I usually explain it, Tim, by saying that we've built ourselves in our educational worlds with a box that's called geology, another one that's called economics, another one that's called physics, another one called mathematics. And at least at the University of Copenhagen, we put people all the way over on Amma, which is another island a long way away. And it's as if we understand, or we think, that if we could get all the details right in our own little box and everybody was allowed to put their details into one big pot and stir it up, then you would understand the Earth. And it would be just like asking doctors with their different disciplines, with, you know, heads and stomachs and reproduction and feet and all those sorts of things, if they put all their knowledge together, we'd never understand what a person is, because it's interactions between the parts that are important. And it's no mistake, both Tim and I have been involved in developing Earth system science over the last several decades. And it's not a mistake, or it's not an accident, that this didn't happen within a university. It happened in an international fora outside of the university system, because the university system it's Newton who did this to us, this reductionist approach to everything.
You both of you make it sound very obvious, like a banal, like something completely banal, but actually when I was reading up, preparing for this event, it did struck me as though a somewhat different way of thinking of the climate crisis compared to the usual, because we are sort of used to thinking about it like a budget, that there's this amount of CO2 we could put into the air, and then the mm-hmm. temperatures will rise by this, and it's almost like we almost see a linear connection when we close our eyes. Whereas this, and there's something actually comforting about thinking about the climate crisis. Like it implies that we're in control, that it's something we can balance, that it's a budget that's manageable. Whereas this, it sort of expands the problem in a way that does imply something completely beyond our control.
What I'm hoping we'll get to discuss, though, is if you can embrace a systems view and understand feedback, so it actually shows a way out of the massive hole we've dug for ourselves.
Yes.
Because we need these kind of dynamics to accelerate the change we need to have any hope of getting to so-called net zero within a generation globally. There's absolutely no hope of doing that if you honestly believe social and economic and all our other systems are just linear. Because right now, rates of decarbonisation are at least a factor of 5 too slow. That's a radical, radical acceleration that's needed. I think the only hope for that in the complex social realm is to also have this kind of thinking. But yes, you're right, Mike. There is that horrible moment if you're being brought up to think of the world as like a gigantic clockwork machine or something, or, you know, where response is proportional to shove. When you realize, okay, maybe it isn't, and maybe it just, look at, you study Earth history like I've done for decades, and you realize it just doesn't behave like that, then you can take it either way. You're suddenly dealing with something that feels a lot more organic. It can be scary, the thought that you can really know, and there have been these incredible abrupt changes. But we actually wouldn't be here to talk about it if Earth wasn't a beautiful, complex system in which life has always played a profound role in shaping the conditions for habitability.
And let's get back to the potential of the tipping point way of thinking about mm-hmm. things. But there's still this hard realization with this way of thinking. There's the hard realization, as Catherine put it, there are things that are either there or they're not. It's not like something where we can just roll things back. Even if we invent the most miraculous technology, the most profound large-scale carbon capture system, it's not like we'll get the Amazon back working exactly the way it did 200 years ago. It's not like we'll get the Earth system back to some idealized, romanticized way that it was before. We have changed the system.
We have changed
and
the
you can't just roll it back. It has put in motion forces that are beyond our immediate control anyway.
In theory, if you manage to get control of the release of greenhouse gases, in theory, after thousands of years, sorry, it's a mixture, a very strange mixture of Danish and English. After thousands of years, you will end up in a situation where the energy balance of the Earth no longer has a fingerprint of human activity. Unfortunately, the conditions on Earth are actually determined by the interaction between the biosphere, which is all living organisms, and what makes our planet unique, by the way. The conditions on Earth are made by this interaction between biology or living organisms and the energy balance. And every time you lose an organism and it goes extinct, it's gone forever. So you can never go back to a biosphere that doesn't have a human imprint. So you're right. I mean, even if we could get the energy balance to at least on paper look the same, because this is almost a closed system. About the only thing we get from outside the system in the Earth is energy and the occasional meteor and things like that. But, you know, energy is the real thing we take from outside. The rest of it we have, it's a closed system. It's a zero sums game and we have to work within that.
Yeah, it's picking up the theme. It's we have to sort of embrace being an integral part of this system. Don't delude yourself that you can in any sense be picture yourself outside of it. This is we are in it, and it is our life support system. And we wouldn't have come up with a word like the Anthropocene if we didn't think we were radically transforming it already. It's all about where's the trajectory going? Which trajectory are we going to go on? Are we going to carry on the one that with high probability are going to break our civilization? Or are we going to be wise enough to see that as an integral part of this system, we can get to a long-term, flourishing, sustainable state in a so-called circular economy powered by renewable energy with probably rather different ways of flowing information within society, and certainly with a greater diversity of ways of doing certain key underpinning functions like feeding ourselves? So yeah, there's a whole lot to get stuck into there.
But Tim, that's why I'm so excited about understanding these interactions better and better. Because as far as I mean, knowledge is power. And when you understand these interactions, then we can do something about them. We couldn't when we didn't understand them. And people say to me, don't you get terribly terribly depressed with the kind of work you do? And the answer is no, because the more we understand about how these things work, the greater our potential for being able to do something about it actually is.
And as you started off by saying, the concept of tipping point has become more central to the climate science in the past decade, and this more holistic way of thinking about the crisis we're in has also become more profound. When you see the IPCC report, the latest, it has many
politicians,
more. Huh?
But not necessarily the politicians.
Exactly. So maybe the climate science has adopted and placed more emphasis on this way of thinking. But the general narrative of the climate crisis is still very reliant on this atmospheric budget way of thinking.
Although to give some credit where it might be due, I've been working for the last, I don't know, 18 months with Simon Sharp, one of the COP26 team in the UK Cabinet Office that withholding the presidency of the current negotiations. And it's really Simon that's been provoking me to and helping me identify the positive tipping points in social change, technological change, and so on. So there are some very, very smart people in the corridors of government, not a politician, a civil servant, but a key one, shall we say. I think like every realm of human endeavor, there are probably some people who get this stuff and some who don't. And yes, it takes time for a new worldview, which is really what we're talking about, to filter its way through the collective consciousness. But let's keep talking about it because it offers some great opportunities to rescue the situation.
Yeah, okay. A couple of years ago, the two of you wrote an analysis in the scientific journal Nature, along with five of your colleagues, five other climate scientists.
Including the grandfather.
Including the grandfather.
About,
both the father, the grandfather, and I won't even get into what that makes you. But it was quite grim reading. Mm-hmm. When you read it, it was, we are already in a state of planetary emergency. And can you maybe just sum up, how far are we away from these tipping points? It is, well, 5 or 10 years ago, we had a sense of regarding this as something way out into the future.
Yeah, well, if we were in a part of Western Antarctica in that so-called Amundsen Sea embayment, and we were watching Pine Island Glacier and Thwaites Glacier there, they are retreating in a way that accelerates, that becomes self-propelling beyond a certain point where the particular kind of geography of the seabed is such, and the physics of ice retreat is such that it really self-propelling, so-called grounding line retreat. We are either at or very close to that point for those two glaciers. We are talking there about, they drain 1 point something meters of global sea level rise. Okay, they're not going that quickly yet, but it's a process which is self-accelerating. So we are possibly at or close to tipping points in West Antarctica. There's some evidence that similar dynamics might be unfolding in a part of East Antarctica called the Wilkes Basin. Over in Greenland, that we maybe feel is a bit more familiar because it's a bit nearer, and obviously opposite for a Danish audience. The ice sheet continues to shrink at an accelerating rate. We've had some extraordinary days of rainfall on the ice sheet just this recently in the summer. Can we rule out that is on its path to irreversible shrinkage? No, we can't. So that just gives you a flavor of some of the icy bits of the system where we might or we might not have, but we might be very close to committing to long-term sea level rise of the order of 10 meters. By long-term, we mean many centuries at the moment. So that breathes a slight sigh of relief if you want to. I could go further because we pick up the signal of loss of stability in the Amazon rainforest, which recycles its own rainfall and so on. And we see a pronounced weakening of the Atlantic overturning circulation that we would like to think is within the range of natural variability, but only just if it is. And we also pick up these early warning signals that it's clearly destabilizing. So yeah, it sounds really bleak and it is not easy to live with if you work on this stuff day in, day out. So that's why I spent quite a lot of time for the last couple of years also trying to work on how can we find some positive tipping points to avoid the worst, to change the way we are and the way we live.
But the point in all this, Tim, I mean, no one can say for certain. And every time you say, oh, well, 2 degrees for melting of Greenland. I mean, we do Greenland a lot here. Then somebody else comes in and says, oh, no, I don't think so. And then it says in the paper, oh, well, you know, science isn't certain. And we don't know exactly when it's going to go. But the point here is something we don't talk about at all, and that's risk. Mm-hmm. And that the risk, and that was for me, that was the most important message in that 2018 paper that Matthias is referring to, that when the UN climate, when IPCC first mentioned these tipping points in 2001, they said, oh, we don't think this is going to happen before there's 5 degrees of warming. And we got to 2007, they said, well, maybe 3 degrees. And we got to 2013, and they said, 2 degrees. And then they had their special cryosphere report in 2018 that said, well, maybe we're almost there for the West Antarctic ice sheet. And it's this increase, the more we understand about the system and how it works together, that it seems that the risk is becoming greater and greater. And you know, there was a film a long time ago about an inconvenient truth, but if there ever was an inconvenient truth, the fact that it seems that the risk of all this happening, it just seems to be becoming greater and greater. I don't understand why it isn't more a part of the discourse that society has about climate change. It's all down to, oh, oh, we'll just find some technology and don't worry, nobody has to pay more and nobody has to do anything differently, but we'll get some technology and we'll be fine. Yeah. There's no answer to that. It's just the risk thing. It's just the risk thing that I wanted to get into.
Yeah, I mean, that Matthias and audience was why I tried to write the paper, was to say we really are in a climate emergency, and if you're in an emergency, you should be acting urgently to do something about it. And frankly, when the financial crash was starting in 8-9, our elected representatives, well, they had a bit of hesitation, but they didn't hesitate too much to pour enormous amounts of capital into propping up banks that were otherwise going to bankrupt very quickly. Okay,
about corona.
Or we have the coronavirus, exactly. Okay, this has got some other qualities as an existential threat. It does unfold sort of slower than some of those, but it's more profound as an existential risk. So it was really to just hammer home. Here's the metaphor a friend of mine gave me for it. It's like, imagine you're a factory owner and you run, I don't know what process you do, but you have some big boiler that's essential to what you do. And the engineer from the boiler comes to you one week and says, if that boiler heats up 5°C, it's going to blow up and destroy the factory. And you think, that's all right. They come back the next week. They say, no, actually, I've reassessed. And if it warms up 3°, just it might blow up. And you're starting to get nervous. They come back again the next week and they say, I've had another reassessment. And now I think it's like 2°. At some point, as a factory owner, you're going to turn around and say to the engineer, stop coming back and tell me when the boiler is going to blow up. Tell me what I have to do to stop it blowing up. And that's basically what that paper is trying to say.
And I suppose the element of uncertainty is also one of the explanations as to why it doesn't have a more central role in the discourse on climate central. It's hard to jam the tipping points into the climate models we usually use, especially the economic ones. The most vulgar examples of this kind of thinking about the climate crisis, the Nordhaus models, for instance, economists that have tried to like make models that would point to the optimal temperature increase, where it could like... where the cost, the benefits, this would be the economic cost, this would be the planetary cost, and then maybe the optimal one would be, I think he landed on 3.7 or something preposterous.
Yes, I know those models quite well and have played with them, and I can tell you for sure they have only one equilibrium or stable state. So whatever you do to try and break the economy in dice, it will eventually come back to its... to what's wired in, which is its sort of perpetual, roughly 2% year-on-year economic growth.
And I think he actually got the Nobel Prize in economics, but I think he disregarded the concept of tipping points altogether because he said...
Well, but his models were very early on, and he actually
he said
did
it,
some...
Yeah, okay, he did
he was
adjust
the first
them
that
later
really
on.
Tried to put it in
but
here.
But originally he said that it's too... Yeah, unlikely.
Yeah, I'm just going to disregard it completely.
Well, Bill Goldhouse, to his credit, did put in a nominal tipping point, and he actually argued that a collapse of the Atlantic overturning circulation would have impacts comparable to the Great Depression of the 1920s and 30s, so a 25% reduction of global GDP. It's just he assigned it a probability that was spectacularly inaccurately low. He eliminated the risk effectively by just arbitrarily pulling out a 0.0000 something percent probability, or rather what he thought was a low probability. I can tell you, though, actually, it's that tipping point risk is still responsible for at least half of the damages, or what's called the social cost of carbon, in DICE. So if he'd got the probability even vaguely right, it would completely dominate his cost benefit analysis and the analysis.
I'm actually also primarily mentioning him because he's an example of I suppose the complete opposite way of thinking about this crisis, not thinking in Earth systems, not thinking in like trying to isolate and make it specifically into
but very few even of the models, and you know, Tim's probably going to jump down my throat here, but as I see it, even the models that we have that the UN, you know, the IPCC is relying on right now are basically physics assuming that biology is riding on the backs of physics, and we haven't got real good control over the kinds of interactions that are between the biosphere and the physics, or the possibility of tipping points. I mean, you don't have the melting of permafrost in these models because we really don't know how it's going to work. And there's a lot of things that we know are out there, but we can't translate to mathematical language yet, so they're not in those models. So the models are only as good as what we really understand and can put in there. And there's so much out there that we know is there that we don't have a handle on totally.
So what should we do? What should the scientists at the IPCC do?
The IPCC is doing what it should be doing, but it should people should understand that those scenarios aren't the truth. And you know, one of the things I think that's most worrying about the IPCC is that, and this is where journalists come in, and you're one of those, but their last report, the IPCC said, and this is the one before this one, said, okay, with over 95% certainty, most of the climate change or global warming we've seen in the last half a century is human-caused. Okay, then they came to this report, and they said, there's basically no doubt that this is human cause. And the journalist jumped up and said, whole new message from the IPCC. Now they really know. And I can only conclude that statistics is not really a part of the journalistic training here in Denmark. Because if you say something is not over 95% certain that humans are, you've basically said, this is where it's at. And when people didn't understand that, they now say, okay, this is where it's at, and journalists jump up and say, now they've finally decided.
Okay. But I'd actually say that's one of the uplifting things in the past decade or in the past 5 years or so, that we've sort of, in Denmark anyway, moved beyond that debate. Like when you open the newspaper in Denmark, nobody's really discussing anymore whether or not it's human-made.
But surely you were at that point in 2009 when you hosted the COP, whatever number it was, after the climate gate scandal.
15, but who's counting?
Exactly. I mean, if you hadn't woken up and smelt the coffee by then, we have now. That's something better late than never. But yeah, you, Matthias, you were probing on economics a minute ago. It's a broad church, and it's a particular subset of macroeconomics, as it's called, that's rather ruled the roost here. But we have to get beyond the really shoddy climate economics that's been informing these IPCC reports. Usually it's in a mixture of, well, it tends to appear in the, not the working group one, the science, but in two on the impacts or three on the what we should do about it. But you still have, in at least in the last assessment report, the mainstream message of IPCC being that only activities that are exposed to the weather, like farming, can possibly be impacted by climate change. Try telling that to someone whose house burnt to the ground during the recent extreme heat waves and forest fires that were kicking off in Greece or in Northwest US and Canada. I mean, it's ludicrous. But so what they've done, those particular economists, is they've said like more than 80% of the productive economy is guaranteed immune to climate change, which is obviously complete garbage.
I'm going to ask one last bleak question before we get to the hope. But let's let's assume that we already reached the tipping point at the West Antarctic. Mm-hmm. What are the implications of that? What are the cascading effects? What are the ripple effects of that? Can you take us on a little tour around the world?
I could. I would actually probably start the narrative in the Arctic, which is a bit closer to home, where we know, you know, it's warming two or three times as fast as the global average. We know it's contributing to the accelerated melt of the Greenland ice sheet. We know the meltwater coming off Greenland is slowing down the Atlantic overturning circulation. And we know that that starts to disrupt rainfall around the tropics and monsoon systems, leaves heat behind in the Southern Ocean where it can interact with and contribute to destabilizing these Antarctic ice sheets. As those Antarctic ice sheets go, the extra sea level rise, interestingly, because of the Earth's gravity field, tends to be greatest at the opposite pole. So you get Greenland and Antarctica start doing nasty things to each other, because if you raise the sea level in a what's called a marine grounded ice sheet or ice shelf, like you see around West Antarctica and parts of East Antarctica, that physically destabilizes the ice sheet, as it will for some of the outflowing glaciers on Greenland. So yeah, there's a little swift tour of some of the couplings. And I haven't even mentioned, you know, when you when your accelerated Arctic warming is thawing the permafrost and releasing methane and CO2 to the atmosphere, of course, that's adding to the warming. And yeah, the Amazon rainforest is coupled to those changes in the Atlantic in a way that, yeah, potentially that's just exacerbating the risks that we're seeing with extreme droughts and fires, turning the Amazon from what was our most important so-called carbon sink to a potential carbon source now, again, adding to the warming.
So potentially we have already set this self-amplifying mechanism in motion that are...
Yeah, the only saving grace is I don't think it's in what we call the runaway condition, which is where you really can't stop it. Might seem a subtle distinction, but it's an important one. When we talk about amplifying feedbacks in our field, they are often constrained. So a runaway is a particularly dangerous state you get to where you warm the system up by 1 degree, and then the change you get back from the system adds another degree to the warming, and so on and so on. That's where you've lost control. We're nowhere near that point, thankfully, yet, globally, although can't be ruled out. And even locally within systems, that's what we've got to try and avoid, because it's when you get to that runaway condition in the feedbacks within one of these systems, like an ice sheet, that you've got no control over the situation anymore.
It's not our politicians. It's like we've gotten to a narrative that says, okay, our politicians go to Paris and decide what future temperature is going to be. And then they go to Glasgow and they decide what future temperature is going to be. And there's a couple of players on the field that also have an idea about what the temperature is going to be in the future and want to play their hand too. But we haven't actually got them at the table. And it's things, silly things like physics and ice and you know, albedo and biology. But it's not just the politicians that do this.
And Tim, you actually managed to find some sort of hope in this way of conceptualizing things as well, because the same mechanism, the same thing that can connect melting ice to droughts in West Africa to making coastal cities in Australia unlivable, this whole thing where it's all connected, you also found some hope in that. At Exeter University, where you work, you have a project where you try to identify tendencies with potential of hope. You call them positive tipping points.
That's right. I mean, we see some actual examples where these amplifying or reinforcing feedbacks in society and in our relationship with technology or other living things, ecology, can get so strong that you start to get self-propelling change in society. Examples would include Norway has switched to buying electric cars ahead of petrol or diesel cars. And there's a whole rich backstory to why they've gone first, and all the role that the pop band Aha played in starting that, the role that some clever changes of the policy context have played in supporting it. Yes, there are some issues. The electric car is not a perfect technology, but it's clear when we plotted how the market share of electric vehicles depended on the price difference to a petrol or diesel car, it's incredibly, we say, non-linear. In Norway, where it costs the same to buy at the dealership, the consumer buys electric vehicle. In the rest of Europe, even if it's very close to cost equal, it's only a 5 or 10% market share. So that's an interesting one. Meanwhile, I talked to you from the UK, where in the last 10 years, coal burning has gone from 40% of power generation to less than 1% in the last 10 years. So I can talk about how that happened, but it only took a very subtle change in the price of carbon in power generation to tip a series of reinforcing feedbacks where investors pulled out of coal and then utilities destroyed coal power plants, an irreversible change. And now I'm super interested in finding other examples of this. And I suppose Greta is the kind of archetypal example of starting a social tipping point where this is kind of well known in a particular field, that if someone changes their public position on an issue, in this case, protests and you know, stops going to school on a Friday or whatever, makes it incrementally easier for the next person to join them in the protest, which makes it incrementally easier for the next one, and so on and so on. And I think we all witnessed that within a matter of months, we went from one protester to many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of protesters marching together on the streets. That's self-reinforcing feedback. And so that's, yeah, it's in those kinds of positive tipping point dynamics. So I'm putting a lot of my energy now trying to work out what's the recipe for finding and triggering them, and how can we all play a part in triggering them? Because we don't have to sit around twiddling our thumbs and complaining about our politicians not solving the problem for us if we have the agency to go out there and actually start to trigger these changes.
Okay, so you can sort of identify the same sort of cascading ripple effect. Because they buy a lot of electrical cars in Norway, it leads to cheaper electrical cars, advancement in battery technology that they can then ripple over to other electrification in other sectors.
Exactly. And to illustrate how these things are coupled, well, if we think about the renewable energy revolution, what's the one fundamental challenge it places? It's when I want to boil the kettle isn't necessarily when the wind's blowing or the sun's shining, so I need cheap storage of power. Well, what's one place I'm going to get that? Really cheap battery storage. And where's, and the economies of scale, as they're called, in the electric vehicle revolution that's unfolding, is basically batteries are just getting spectacularly cheaper the more car electric vehicles are made. And that helps enable the renewable energy revolution, which feeds back on the electrification of transport, right? Because if you're going to electrify transport, you want to do it with the cleanest electricity you can get. So then you've got these cascades within the economy. Then you're going to be, I don't know where you're at with in Denmark, but I bet when the wind's blowing really hard, you probably you'll have days when you may overproduce electricity. I hope you're dumping that down into green hydrogen and you're just making green hydrogen. And there you've got then you can start to tip the transition for heavy goods transport, hydrogen fuel cells. The point is to illustrate, you know, the potential for these cascading interactions.
But I think it's always useful when you're talking about these kinds of things, Tim, to point out that this has happened before. We've had lots of social tipping points, and sometimes it's technology that does it. I mean, somebody went from horse-drawn carriages to cars, and it went very, very quickly when it happened. The whole smoking thing in society, you know, in Denmark, it wasn't actually all that many years ago that the best thing you could give a young person when they were confirmed at the age of 14 or 15, if you had the money for it, was to rip all their teeth out and give them false teeth so they wouldn't have to have the pain of bad teeth the rest of their life. And, you know, of course, now it's an entirely different situation. So there's always been social tipping points. What's different here is the fact that until now, when we've evolved as a society, you know, oh, somebody discovered a tractor and wonder where this tractor is going to take us. Sort of no focus on the end point. And now, thanks to understanding the system and maybe planetary boundaries for that matter, we know the biophysical constraints on what we have to do for our food production, our energy production, or whatever. So somehow these tipping points have to feed into, or these social tipping events have to feed into arriving at the end goal, and that's what's really different.
Exactly, Catherine. And I think if there is one historical example where there was a sort of collective realization that we needed to transform something, it was possibly the Green Revolution in agriculture. Of course, it wasn't as universally collectively realized that there was a food crisis coming, but some people, and including some scientists, certainly realized it. And for good or ill, starting in Mexico, they developed the dwarf varieties of wheat, the intensification of agriculture, a much more productive, with all due caveats about its consequences, agricultural system that then spread out around the world. It jumped to South and Southeast Asia, where the dwarf rice varieties were soon developed. To be honest, about 3 or so billion of us alive today owe our existence to that having happened, whether we like the environmental consequences or not. And now we need this kind of intentional transformation at an even bigger and more profound scale.
Fair, Tim. That's my point. We didn't understand the system and the interactions and the biophysical constraints at the time of the Green Revolution. And I often say that when, you know, if we'd known what we know now at the time of the Green Revolution, it would have looked entirely differently. And of course, the people who want to get the shovel in under me say, oh, you know, well, what about all those people that have, you know, and you think that the Green Revolution was a bad thing, and, you know, what about all the Indians that survived because of it, and blah, blah. It's not that I say it was a bad thing. Our level of understanding at that point wasn't sufficient to be able to give it the constraints that it needed. We need a new Green Revolution.
Exactly. Right? And the metaphorical analogy I like is to the, again, back to the 2008-09 financial crash. Why did some poor, you know, loans on houses in the US nearly bring down the whole house of cards, the economy? Well, because as a network, the system of lending and loaning between banks was spectacularly prone to instability. You had a very few major actors dominating the market space, as it were, the loan space, and they were all behaving in the same way. So you had a very homogeneous network with a few major actors, and as soon as they were vulnerable, everyone was vulnerable. Well, as George Monbiot has been making me think, look at the food system now. You've got, what is it, four or five really big companies dominating global food. You've got homogenized agricultural systems. It looks a whole lot like the network terms. It looks a whole lot like the financial system before it crashed spectacularly 2008-09. We desperately need to reinvent that system to be resilient in ways that should be obvious, but we can talk about more.
Exactly. And there's also very few different varieties that we're doing. But I think we have so much we can learn from nature in this, because nature does tell us that redundancy is a good thing. And I have a big research project at the moment, and it's all about looking at the interaction between ocean, climate, land, nature on Iceland and in the ocean, both on land and in the ocean, and also how people responded. So I have three postdocs in the humanities that are a part of my project. And one of them, who I've invited them on the cruise, a cruise I had in June, and one of them came and she performed a poem that she'd written. And I can't tell you what that poem was about, but the method that she used just hit me right in the solar plexus. I mean, she started out using all the letters of the alphabet. And then as time went on and she was writing, she took letters away and could only choose words that had the letters that were left. And in the beginning, it was very understandable, even though she was taking letters away. It was probably less flowery language, but it was very understandable. And then as time went on, it got less and less understandable. And at the end, it was just a series of grunts and noises. And then she looked up and said, "That was species that disappeared." Hmm. Yeah, wow. And I had an economist once ask me, "What's the optimal number of species?" I don't know. So redundancy is something that we need in the system.
Mm. One last question, Tim, to the positive tipping points, because it makes a lot of sense to me in the realm of technology. Like, it makes a lot of sense. We have a lot of, can point to a lot of cases where technological change has happened in these fast, big, dramatic leaps. In terms of the world of politics or the economy, it seems more of a stretch to me that it can happen in a constructive, peaceful manner. I suppose you could argue that we do have a word for tipping points in the political world already, and it's called revolution. I mean, yeah. The way we're used to thinking about this, the consensus, I suppose, is that it takes time to create good social institutions, good political institutions that have public legitimacy and are well functioning. They can't really in the same way happen like this.
Or can they? Because, I mean, to make it personal, my sort of great aunt Lydia Lenton was one of the suffragettes. Now, the suffragettes, I'm not sure how you want to describe that, Matthias, but they did manage to fundamentally change our democracy And they didn't do it by completely overthrowing the established political system, certainly not in this country. And I can't think of an example where they did, but they changed the rules of democracy country by country worldwide. So you didn't have to destroy or burn down the existing framework to have a very important fundamental advance. And you'd say the same about the abolition of the slave trade, I think, going further back. So I wouldn't say there's any sense in which the necessary transformation we're talking about here has to be damaging or fraught, although clearly we're all consumed by thinking through how to make sure any people less well off than ourselves who might suffer from the transformation, that we manage the social democracy, the reallocation of resources and the politics of that so that they aren't disadvantaged. But we've seen in the case of Germany and its coal commission that can be navigated. You can show people who feel like they're going to lose out that there is a different future, and you can help them to get to a good place. So that's just good politics versus often bad politics. On the flip side, I think the danger is we have some spectacularly rich actors who oppose this transformation, and we don't need to do anything to compensate them. They can look after themselves, but those of us in the middle ground have really got to form effective coalitions to win the dynamics, as I think of it, over those rich actors who are opposing change. I'm not troubled that I don't accept the argument that this necessarily has to be, you know, destructively turbulent, but I do recognize that there's some serious power dynamics here. But as long as it's people or organizations or entities that are actually currently spectacularly well off who are going to take the hit, I frankly, on a moral level, doesn't deeply concern me. As long as poorer people are protected, that's all that should be our moral compass on this, in my view. And I think the really interesting territory here is actually, we haven't talked about it, it's the positive tipping we get if we work with other species to tip change in systems where humans are coupled to nature, like our food production systems. There's a whole lot of evidence that if we work with nature, sort of, people talk glibly about regenerative agriculture, but when it comes to the brass tacks, what you're really talking about there is you work with natural ecological dynamics that are true to all life. Life is here recycling all the elements and the water and whatever it needs in order to flourish all around us. We just align with that there's no reason we can't have diverse and highly productive food systems. There's no reason we can't regenerate degraded tropical forests, and similarly for marine ecosystems. And that's a whole territory we're sort of starting to talk about, but for me, it's all under the same conceptual roof, you know, the same core principles. So that's about basically, in my radical view of things, it's a bit like giving a democratic voice to other species, something I'm sympathetic to, even though it sounds practically very hard to do. But it's some way, it's just about recognizing the agency of other living things that we really depend on in this great transformation.
And I suppose very much in line with thinking about the planet as an Earth system.
Yeah.
I think with those words, thank you, Tim. Thank you for speaking to us. It was a great pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Tusind tak, Catherine. Det var en stor fornøjelse at komme her i dag.
Sådan lød altså dagens afsnit om Tipping Points. Som altid var arrangementet støttet af Novo Nordisk Fonden, og som altid håber jeg, at du vil lytte med igen i næste uge. Her får vi Sebastian Merlind på besøg. Han er hovedforfatter på FN's klimarapport, og vil fortælle hele historien om klimaforandringerne forfra. Tak for nu.